Aaron Durham, you were the filmmaker behind this Julian Price documentary. How did this film get started?
Well, I think it was probably in the process for a while. Meg and Karen and the Julian Price committee, they've been talking about doing this all-encompassing project, a website, a film, an oral history where people can go and add to the research over time. I think they've been talking about it for a really long time. But I first got involved, I guess it was a year and a half ago at this point, and it started off really small. It was going to be this little max 20-minute oral history where we were just getting interviews and I was going to, you know, put them into one cohesive story. And then I got the interviews and I was like, oh no, these are really good. I don't know how I'm going to do it. 15 to 20 minute piece, which now it's just over 30, but even that was so difficult. You know, I did over 30 interviews with people that were related to him or friends with him or who were just helped by him and never actually met him. So it was a really inspirational interview process.
And I'm betting each one of those interviews probably lasted about 30 minutes or maybe even longer.
Well over, yeah. And Meg's was half a day.
Wow.
And Rachel Price's daughter was another half day, about 4 hours. And for the most part, I think typically my interviews run about 45 minutes. And that was definitely the case for this project. It was hard because people love him so much, even the ones who hadn't met him, but they were, you know, their careers are based around what he did for them. So they had a lot to say.
Yeah. So that must have been agonizing in the editing process.
It was really hard. It was so hard. Yeah, I mean, the way I normally do it is I, you know, watch all the interviews over again and I pull out some key themes or some things that just have to, you know, that represent him. And I checked with Meg and Karen first and, you know, made sure that they agreed that the themes were the, you know, the appropriate themes for the movie. Then I just started pulling sound clips from everybody. And because it's a 30-minute piece, not everyone we interviewed was included in the film, sadly, but it would have just made no sense if I'd done that. I'd been like, who's that?
So you could have done a feature-length film, really.
I still want to, honestly, because it's, I mean, the reason I got involved was, you know, I usually pick projects based on, you know, what, you know, I'm a historian, I have a master's in history. I base projects on, should this be in a history book? Would I want my daughter to read about this 10 years from now in a history class? And I usually pick things that other people would never put in a history book, you know. So I did the, you know, the documentary on street performers because that's not really, you know, people haven't been researching that a ton. And Julian Price, when I first heard about him from my friend and fellow filmmaker, Robert Klein, he told me about Julian and I was straight up embarrassed that I had never heard of him. I was like, I'm a historian and I've never heard of the man who, you know, is not solely responsible for Asheville, but, you know, hugely responsible for what we have today.
You and me both.
Yeah.
they had to come and tell me who this guy was.
It's crazy.
But you've only been here a few years, so it's understandable.
Yeah, but my family's from Greensboro. They played golf at Setchfield, which is where he, you know, grew up. And when I told my grandfather I was doing this project, he was like, oh, I knew his dad. And I was like, oh, man, you know. So it's one of those things that I immediately wanted to work on it because he's a historical figure that isn't known and will be forgotten if people don't start talking about him and start archiving what he did. So that was the main reason I signed on. But then when I did the interviews, it became very personal. And I realized that beyond the A to Z historical timeline of what he did, who he was so inspirational. I just want everybody to hear his story, and I want everyone to realize that what he did wasn't just giving millions of dollars to the city. It was uplifting people that he thought, I don't know, would value it the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, he just did stuff that I wish I did, you know, like seeing a park bench that was broken and fixing it, and seeing a tree grate that was strangling the tree and sending in pictures to the city and making sure someone fixed it or that tree was going to die. These are like little things, but they make a huge difference in the town. And he planted flowers in Pritchard Park and just got people involved and empowered people who either didn't have the means or didn't have the education to follow through with their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. You know?
Yeah.
when I started getting into it, I contacted some universities. I was like, we definitely need to make sure this stuff goes into your business departments, and people are just inspired by this, I think, a really unique form of philanthropy that's cyclical rather than just giving all of your money away. It's how he did it enables public interest projects to keep doing it, to keep giving money to people and making sure that fellow dreamers are uplifted like they were when he was alive. I had never heard of that kind of philanthropy before. It was like, if you're a philanthropist, it's a nonprofit and you just give it away and hope that the people do the right thing. But that's not what he did. And that's largely due to Pat Whalen, which is a huge piece of this puzzle. And Pat is like, he's so humble and he's so like, he doesn't, he's like, no, this is about Julian. I'm like, no, like you really have to have Pat to have Julian, you know, like Julian would have just kept seeing someone on the street with a broken leg and writing them a check. I hope you're okay. You know, but Pat just kind of helped him figure out the best way to spend his money to where it could keep helping people.
It sounds like Julian's energy and inspiration sort of infected you during this process also. Yeah. I guess maybe he had that kind of ability to just spread that around.
Yeah. He's extremely inspirational. I mean, he's been gone for over a decade, and he still influences not only the business owners in this town, but the policymakers in this town. I interviewed Kathy Ball, who's the assistant city manager, and the way she spoke about him and how she really, sometimes it was hard to hear what him and what Pat had to say, but that it made her a better person and a better public servant. You could tell she genuinely meant that. And you see the same thing with Hector Diaz at Salsa's when he talks about him and he tears up and, you know, says he's going to drink margaritas with him in heaven. And, you know, like people just think about him every day. And now I do. And I feel like everybody I interviewed, and Meg and Rachel and Karen, they're so inspirational. And I think that really is rooted in Julian's influence.
Does this happen to you a lot when you start making a documentary, that it becomes something bigger than you expected it to be, or that you sort of get sucked in kind of the way that you have?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, because, I mean, I think it's also in the way that I select a project. I don't select something because someone wants to pay me or because it's a big subject matter for the year. Like with Buskin' Blues, I saw street performers in Asheville and thought they were incredible and wanted to know more. So that was just going to be, I wanted to turn it into an exhibit and then do a little 5-minute video piece. And I filmed them almost for a year. And now it's a feature film and it's all over the world. So the street performers in Asheville, I still interact with every day and talk to and want to be a huge part of their future here. So, yeah, eventually I guess I'll have to stop taking jobs because I'll like forever be doing stuff for Julian Price and for Buskers and all the other stuff I'm doing right now. But
and were you approached for this project?
Yes.
Yeah. And why did they come to you, do you think?
Well, it was through Robert Klein, who, you know, had been talking back and forth with them, and they mentioned they were interested in an oral historian. And he was like, wow, I happen to know one of those. Because it's not a new career by any means. It's one of the oldest careers, but it's a new term. I think a lot of people haven't heard of an oral historian before. I usually have to explain what it is. So he brought me in, and Karen interviewed me from Mexico via the phone. And we talked forever, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful conversation. And then I think a couple of days later, Meg and I spoke, and I think it was maybe less than 5 minutes before we were both crying. I mean, it was like, you know, it's Meg, and she's just a wonderful person. So it's
She says she cries easy.
She does cry easy. And I mean, I do too. So, but she, I felt connected to this project immediately before we started interviewing. But then when we started interviewing and I just realized how all encompassing what he did was, I knew it was going to be impossible to tell the story fully, even in an hour and a half. But the 30-minute piece, it just barely touches on on the things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, barely. Like, I give maybe one or two examples of each thing that he did. And I, you know, didn't even get into, you know, the majority of his nonprofit work. It was mainly his uplifting the business community in mm-hmm. Asheville is kind of what I stayed focused on, just because those are the things that shocked me the most when I first heard about him. I was like, oh, he, you know, he helped Salsas and the Orange Peel and the Fine Arts Theater and Mountain Express and Malaprops. These are like the key places I go to every week. So that's kind of what I wanted to stick to, just to make sure that no matter what that comes across,
mm-hmm.
that like these gems of our city are not 100% due to him by any means, but they would not be here mm-hmm. like they are now without him. So
one of the other major projects that you mentioned working on was about street performers. Mm-hmm. And then this project also has a real musical element to it.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, was it you that sort of had the idea to bring that in?
Yeah. I mean, that's been my mom's a classically trained guitar player and is still a musician. And I just grew up around music. So most of my projects are about music or about musicians' journeys through their records. And I'm really good friends with Jessica Thomason, who is the studio manager at Echo Mountain. And she's started producing all of my films as well, just because we work really well together.
Mm.
And we also work out together. So one day we were with our trainer and I had been hearing about the Symphony Project, which hadn't started recording yet. She was just talking about it a lot. And she knew about Julian Price, and we were talking about him a lot because she used to work at the Orange Peel when she first moved here. So we talked about it a bunch. And then I was really nervous to ask her, even though we're friends. I was like, I don't know. She might just be like, what are you talking? Of course you can't have the music. But I just asked her one day, and she was like, yeah, yeah. And I was like, so it's okay if we could we possibly use, you know, the music from the symphony album for the documentary? And I mean, there were a million steps between that conversation and it actually happening.
Right.
One being we had to wait for the album to be made. We mm-hmm. could have had the documentary done a year ago.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But it, number one, wouldn't have been as good and it wouldn't have this music. I was in the studio for, I think, almost every song and for every minute that the symphony was recording. And yeah, it was hard not to just cry.
Yeah.
The whole time. And most people were. Like, people were either crying or they were just, like, jaws dropped, especially the local musicians like Matt Townsend, who I was filming the symphony when he was listening to them record his song.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he was just, like, sunken down in the chair holding his head, like, oh, you know, just...
Yeah.
Couldn't believe where he was. And it just makes it, since the movie is all about inspiring dreamers and Julian being the biggest dreamer of them all, and then being in a studio where it's happening all over again in a musical way, and then getting it in the movie, it's just, it's like, it's crazy.
So you've been living this project for a long time.
Yeah.
On the 26th, it premieres.
Ah.
What's that going to be like for you? I imagine you're going to cry.
Yes.
But what else is it going to be like?
I'm so excited to see everybody because I've been in my little hole editing or filming, you know, have been having to film a ton to kind of, you know, fill in the gaps here and there, but I run into people a lot and I get really excited, but the 26th, I'll get to see all my crew again and I'll get to see everybody, you know, that we interviewed and all the symphony people, and the symphony people haven't seen it yet. So I'm really excited to just be in a room filled with people that I love.
Well, Erin Durham, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.